It's absolutely huge.
Not much in there, sadly.
All right. Our cost of living correspondent, Kevin Peachey.
Of the UK
and the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The BBC News on 5 Live, I'm Bethan Holmes. Israel says its warplanes are carrying out extensive airstrikes on southern Lebanon. Lebanon's health ministry says the attacks today have killed 15 people. Earlier, Hezbollah fired a missile at Tel Aviv, the first time the Israeli city has been targeted. The missile was intercepted by Israeli military. Well, the UK Foreign Office has urged British nationals to leave Lebanon while seats on commercial flights are still available. The Ministry of Defence says additional troops are being sent to Cyprus as part of plans to evacuate. Editor of the Defence Eye website, Tim Ripley, has been speaking to Adrian on 5 Live.
Everybody remembers those scenes at Kabul airport. The Taliban captured the city and it was anarchy and there were people storming the airport trying to climb on planes and all that kind of thing. This is a very different situation. This is like a full-scale, proper war. Those airstrikes by the Israelis a few days ago on Beirut, they were only less than a kilometre from the airport. The airport is in the neighbourhood of the Hezbollah stronghold in southern Beirut. It's very close to that airport being shut. Once you get to that stage, the British government, the Americans, the French, all the other governments that are involved in this, their first move must be to try and organise some sort of pause to allow the evacuation to take place.
Labour members at the party's conference in Liverpool have backed a union motion calling for the government to reverse its decision to axe some winter fuel payments. The policy will affect around 10 million pensioners in England and Wales. Ministers have defended the decision, saying the Conservatives left a £22 billion black hole in public finances, but the vote is non-binding. The medical regulator, the General Medical Council, says allegations relating to doctors who worked for Harrods when Mohamed Al-Fayed was in charge are deeply concerning. Many of the women interviewed for a BBC documentary say they were subjected to intrusive medical examinations. One woman says she intends to bring a complaint to the GMC about a doctor who worked for the company. Niall Dixon is a former chief executive at The Watchdog and explains what action could be taken.
They can impose a range of sanctions, which range from giving a warning or putting conditions on their practice through to suspension and then through to, it's called erasure, but normal parlance would say striking the doctor off the register, stopping them from being able to practice.
And Sir Alan Bates will receive his knighthood later after he was recognised in the King's Birthday Honours in June. The former sub-postmaster successfully founded a campaign to highlight the Post Office Horizon IT scandal and overturn convictions. Well, those were the news headlines. Now the sports, here's Shojo Saka.
The former Manchester United and Real Madrid defender Rafael Varane has retired from football at the age of just 31. He joined the Italian side Como on a free transfer in July, but he suffered a knee injury on his debut for them last month. Manchester City have confirmed that Rodri did suffer a knee ligament injury during their match against Arsenal on Sunday. No time frame has yet been given for the Spain international's return. And in netball, Australia sealed victory in their three test series against England as they won the decider 69-56 in Victoria. England will now head to New Zealand for another three-match series, which starts in Auckland on Sunday.
This week on 5 Live and 5 Sports Extra.
Tomorrow there's ball-by-ball commentary from the County Championship on 5 Sports Extra.
Bold, and that is that.
And tonight at 8, we'll have updates from the Europa League and live commentary as Liverpool face West Ham in the EFL Cup.
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We feel totally betrayed.
Welcome to Murrayfield.
I listen to you guys all the time.
Adrian Childs. Listen on BBC Sounds.
It's just coming up to 4 minutes past one as violence continues to escalate in Lebanon. Thought we might spend some time just looking back and examining, in my case, certainly, just how little I know about the place, the country's culture and society. And, I mean, to that end, we joined by a couple of people. Firstly, the BBC's former Middle East correspondent, Jim Muir, who joins us from Beirut, where he's lived for many years. Jim, Thanks for joining us. When I was growing up, it was a place that I only knew from being at war. And then it was only later I realised what an amazing place it had been and what a different place it had been. It had been the Monte Carlo of the Middle East. What era was that?
Well, the kind of golden era was really the 60s, but that kind of strand continues right through till this day. I mean, you could still come here and go to especially the eastern bits of Beirut itself, where the nightlife is still pretty hopping. You know, they've got sky bars and goodness knows what. It's still very, very lively. If you're coming in on one of the MEA flights, which actually at the moment are that's the local flag carrier, they're kind of adverts on their TV screens as you're coming in. It's all sort of, you know, young people jigging around in bars and nightclubs and so on. And you'd think that's a total sort of, you know, totally out of sync with what's going on in other parts of the country. So that strand goes on. It's always been a kind of fun-loving place, okay. A place where in the older days, you know, Arabs from the Gulf, for example, come and spend their summer here up in the hills and in the flesh pots of Beirut. So those days are sort of still there in a way. The Arabs have stopped coming, but there's lots of Lebanese who live outside the country and come here for the summer and have a great time. So that kind of golden era strand continues at the same time as this horrendous war strand that's taken over at the moment.
Okay, so this other strand, if we can call it, that has its roots in the ethnic or the religious mix there. Just talk us through that.
Well, Lebanon's a patchwork country. Some would say that it's never really functioned as a kind of integrated state. People tend to have their allegiance to their immediate family and their sect, of which there are, I think, 18 is the right number. But the main ones are kind of like the Christians, which who are divided into different sects as well among themselves. Then you've got Sunni Muslims, Shia Muslims, Druze, and I've probably forgotten some of them, but those are the main ones. And over the years, the kind of tectonic kind of rifts between them have been aggravated, especially in the 80s when a big rift opened up between the Sunni and the Shia Muslims, aggravated by tensions between their kind of regional sponsors, Iran and Saudi Arabia. So these kind of rifts run very deep in Lebanese society. You'll find that Hezbollah, for example, which is rooted very deeply in the Shia Muslim community, although it has strong ties with Iran, it's really not regarded with great joy, I would say, or fondness by many Christians and even by quite a lot of Sunnis and Druze and others. They've really alienated them in quite a lot of ways. And some people in the country feel that they're being dragged into a war which they don't want by Hezbollah and because of its doctrine and because of Iranian incitement, etc. So that's quite a strong feeling. Although one has to say that Hezbollah itself doesn't want a big war with Israel. It's made that clear from the beginning. It wanted to kind of do its duty in the south by firing some rockets across, keeping the Israelis busy on behalf of Gaza. But now everybody's forgotten about Gaza. The Israelis have succeeded in putting that on a kind of back burner, bubbling away in the background, while they focus on the north, i.e. Hezbollah and Lebanon.
Oh, it's interesting that we don't really know, as I understand it, how many there is of which group of people, because I think the parliament was initially constituted based on a census, and then, but that's sort of decades out of date now. And as it's been explained to me in the past, no one's dared to do a new census.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because it would show a different balance of population demographics. The last census was in 1932, so you're talking about 80-odd years. The balance then was declared to be sort of 50-50 Christian-Muslim, but since then it's tilted more. Well, in fact, no, they gave the Christians a majority in those days. It was kind of 6-5 in Parliament. Six seats for every five Muslim seats. And the power was distributed accordingly. The president is always a Maronite Christian. The other Christian groups don't get a look in on that. The prime minister is always a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of parliament, which used to be a pretty token job, but is now much more powerful, is a Shia Muslim. So there's been, and all the way through the administration, jobs are allocated on a sectarian basis. When they make a government, for example, it takes months and months of haggling because there are not just political issues involved, there's sectarian issues, you know, who gets how many seats for their sect. So it's a very complicated system.
And how did Hezbollah become so important, so influential, so key?
Basically, it was kind of overdue in a way. You could say that they put the Shia were, when I first came here a long, long time ago, the Shia were the kind of poor cousins. They were, you know, mainly from the outlying areas, the south and east Lebanon and the Bekaa Valley. They didn't have much political clout, but Hezbollah has kind of raise them up. They're now powerful politically. They have seats in parliament. They have seats in government. They have a kind of blocking vote in parliamentary and political stuff. Like, for example, there hasn't been a president in the country for more than 2 years because Hezbollah is insisting on a particular candidate that some other people don't want. So it's kind of deadlocked. It's partly, I suppose, you could say, because Iran has given it money and arms and so on. Hezbollah is actually more powerful militarily than the Lebanese army. So it can take decisions of war and peace where the Lebanese government can't. It can kind of enjoin them, it can plead with them, it can persuade them. But the real pressure would come actually from the people because, you know, Lebanese people in general, Shia in general, and Hezbollah's own constituency don't want a big war with Israel. They don't want to have to flee their houses as they've just had to do from the south. They don't want their houses destroyed as many of them have been. So they really don't want that. But a lot of the Shia are loyal to Hezbollah because it's kind of put them on the map in a way that they weren't before.
So you said a lot of the conflict in the past was stoked by rivalry between Sunni and Shia Muslims, and it was like a proxy conflict, if you like, between the Sunni Saudi sponsored ones and the Shia Hezbollah Iranian sponsored ones. Where are the Saudis now with the Sunni Muslims? Have they sort of lost interest?
I think they largely have, to be honest. Yeah, they're not playing a big role nowadays. There's also, I should add, a big divide between the Muslim bloc and the Christians as well. We shouldn't lose sight of that. Mm-hmm. The Saudis are kind of out of it. The figurehead here was Saad al-Hariri, the son of Rafiq Hariri, the big, burly, powerful Sunni politician who got assassinated when he was ex-prime minister back in 2005. He is now, his son Saud, who was the kind of anointed Sunni leader, is now living in more or less in exile in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi, where they're building a palace for him. So he's kind of out of it. And there was that bizarre incident a few years ago where he went to Saudi and was essentially sort of almost kidnapped by the Saudis. He had to appear on TV looking very strained and saying he was resigning as prime minister because he felt threatened by Hezbollah. Obviously, he did that under duress. It was a very obscure game that was being played. But since then, the Saudis really have kind of bowed out of the game here, although their ambassador is, I have to say, very active and trying to get agreement on a new president and stuff like that. But the influence of the Sunnis in general has sort of waned quite considerably, I have to say.
We joined Jim by Hani Bosali, business owner and a board member of the Beirut Traders Association. Thanks very much for joining us, sir. So much as the nightclub culture sort of, to some extent, incredibly carries on regardless, does, at some level, is business still being done in between sort of warring factions?
Yes, exactly. I would say when we're talking about the nightclub culture, I wouldn't call it nightclub culture. This is the way of life of the Lebanese people. It is still going on, actually, all over Lebanon up till last week, if you say, because there have been quite some hostilities. If we count for the latest war on Gaza and Lebanon that started about 1 year ago, I would say that last week was the turning point of that war, which moved out from Gaza and concentrated now on northern Israel and southern Lebanon. So with the major attacks that have happened in the last 2 days over a lot of regions in Lebanon, mainly in the south, but also in all over Lebanon, where there are specific military targets, but there have been hits on whole villages, and you have more than 600 killed and more than 1,000 injured. So we are now officially at war. Besides that, and before that, the Lebanese culture and the Lebanese spirit is always a resilient one. And we, and as Lebanese, have been always living with that war, but also having, in a way, between quotes, the joy of life. So whatever the other people telling about us, about the nightclub culture, this is true, and this is always ongoing, in spite of everything. Now, of course, last week is definitely a very bad time for Lebanon. I think people don't have the spirit to go for partying anymore. But we can ascertain and we can confirm that the Lebanese spirit in time of peace, not only for partying, but also for doing business. Okay. And to go against all these challenges, we are still business as usual.
So when you have business meetings or you meet socially and you discuss this terrible situation with your friends, colleagues, acquaintances, are there a mixture of views there? Are there Hezbollah supporters? Are there those who are vehemently against Hezbollah? Well, what dialogue is there?
Well, let me put it in a broader perspective. Yes, there is a lot of discussions and a lot of hot discussions, actually, whether you are with the Hezbollah and what they call the opposition, the axis of resistance, Al-Mumana'a. Access, or you are more with a unified Lebanon. That's true. That's happening, and even between friends. But I can tell you also that globally, and I'm talking all over Lebanon, this is not the main issue. When we go out to a restaurant or to a nightclub, our friends are not always, never actually, from one religion or one sect. Contrary to the belief of all the world, the Lebanese people themselves are all united in that thing. My bunch of friends, myself, is a mixture of all religions and all sects, and we might have our differences, but we are all agreeing on the unified Lebanon. So the polarization that you see in the news exists, of course, and exists in a few people. But when you're saying about the normal Mr. Smith, the normal Lebanese, he doesn't really, really get into that thing, and it's not so much polarized. And my own circle of friends is a mixture from all religions and from all sects. So yeah. I have to really stress on that the Lebanese spirit, the people that really want a unified Lebanon, are a majority. And I can get you examples. For example, when there was the appraisal 4 years ago in September 2019, when there was an appraisal over the a raise over the government, and there was people on the streets. They were not from one single religion or one single sect. Mm-hmm. If you go back to 2005, when there was the huge appraisal, and when the Syrian army was kicked out after the assassination of Prime Minister Hariri, there was 2 million people on the streets, and they were from all sects and from all religions. So these are the points that we have to stress upon when we're talking sociology, when we're talking culture. We're not talking politics anymore. This is a very important point that everybody should know.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Jim Muir, we've just been told that our Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, is calling for an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon, which you would have expected him to do at the UN Security Council emergency meeting later, but he's the first G7 leader to actually call for that. Well, does that change anything for you?
I'm afraid not. I'd like to think that you know, ceasefire calls from outside would make a difference, but frankly, no. There have been many people calling for truces, the UN people and all the rest of it, but no. I mean, I think basically the current escalation is because Israel has decided to put Gaza on the back burner and to make Hezbollah the big issue. Hezbollah, its position from the beginning, since last October, has been very clear. It said, we're doing what we're doing in the south, you know, firing stuff across into Israel to keep the Israelis busy, to support Gaza. When there's peace in Gaza, we will stop immediately. That's what happened in November when there was a week-long truce. And it went quiet in the south. But the Israelis are now determined to kind of silence Hezbollah, make it, I mean, defang it, if you like, take its rockets out completely. And that's, so they seem to be determined on that. The only reason they would stop would be if Hezbollah somehow agreed to pull back from the border as Israel would like, to give a big space, a big sort of dead zone, a buffer zone in the south. They're not going to do that unless there is a truce in Gaza, which is not really on the front burner at the moment. So it's going to go on. The Israelis are determined to neutralize Hezbollah. That, in the view of many people, is a very, very tall order, which has nowhere near been met yet. So if nothing changes and the Israelis stay on that course, Hezbollah, you know, is managing somehow to keep firing rockets, despite the fact that their rocket chief was killed yesterday in a strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut. They lost a whole raft of senior military leaders buried under a building in South Beirut last week. They've taken huge blows. There's the business of the exploding pagers and walkie-talkies, which knocked out something like 1,500 Hezbollah fighters, as well as about the same number of other people. So they've taken huge blows, but they're still firing rockets. And as long as they keep firing rockets, the Israelis will keep hitting, and it will go on.
Thanks very much indeed, Jim Muir, for some time BBC Middle East correspondent, and also to a businessman in Beirut, Hani Bousali. Just gone 20 past one. We are joined by one of the men behind the infamous Led by Donkeys organisation, collective. What do we call you? Ben Stewart. What are you? What would you describe yourself? Campaigning organisation?
Hi, Adrian. I'm not sure we've been called infamous before, but I'll take it. I think one newspaper the other day called us a satirical artistic collective, and my mum sent that to me quite chuffed, so maybe we'll go with that. But to be honest, we kind of struggle to define it, really, and I even struggle to my own kids. We kind of design interventions and social media films to progress what we think is progressive politics and hold politicians and powerful people to account. So I guess one example would be something like when we found where Michelle Mo's yacht was. She was the baroness who had supplied £200 million of PPE, and most of it was useless. And we found her yacht in a marina south of Barcelona, went down and renamed it as the Pandemic Profiteer. So we do that kind of thing.
The new book is called Led by Donkeys, Adventures in Art, Activism and Accountability. It briefly originally came about through your opposition to Brexit, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. We were back in, I mean, if you cast your mind back to late 2018, early 2019, we were a bit nonplussed by the state of British politics and the chaos that had kind of enveloped the country. And we were passing around at a pub, just four of us, David Cameron's infamous tweet, if you remember that one. Britain faces an inescapable choice, stability and strong government with me, or chaos with Ed Miliband. And we thought, wow, I mean, we really are in chaos, aren't we? And we thought, you know, it'd be a shame if he deleted it. And we looked out the window and saw a big billboard out the window. And we thought, why don't we print it out and paste it up on that billboard, which we did. And then we started pasting up the tweets of Brexit-supporting politicians who had promised the country so much but weren't delivering it. And it was a kind of source, I guess, of accountability. But for us, it was pretty cathartic as well to do that kind of thing.
Okay. That cathartic is interesting because, okay, it made you feel a lot better. And, you know, I get that. And it got a wry smile from people who generally on the remaining side of things. But in the end, what was the purpose of it beyond that, beyond sort of general amusement? Do you imagine it changed anyone's point of view, or did it just harden? Just if you're a Brexiteer, you weren't going to be for changing just having seen that. Or, I mean, there's one, a Liam Fox one, a tweet from him you put up on a billboard. The free trade agreement that we will do with the European Union should be one of the easiest in human history. Okay, you know, you probably hit the bullseye there, but would it change anything?
It's a great question. Great question. We asked ourselves that question all the time. And I think the audience for those original posters, and this is 5 years ago, in a sense, was actually the media. We felt that, you know, our political culture now is so speedy. These things are said and tweeted, and then they go down the memory hole and no one remembers what they're said. And we felt that we were going down into that memory hole and dragging them out and putting them up on billboards and saying, next time you interview Liam Fox, I think you need to ask him about his previous statement. The next time you interview Michael Gove, you need to ask him about his statement that we hold all the cards, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that was the purpose of that. And then it kind of moved on the project, and we started doing, you know, undercover journalism and that kind of thing. We did the COVID memorial wall opposite Parliament. And one of the things we really tried to do is elevate other groups that don't have a voice. And we found ourselves with a pretty big social media voice now. And so we went to COVID Bereaved Families for Justice, and we worked with them to do the wall opposite Parliament. It was originally 140,000 hand-painted hearts. I think it's a lot more now. So we don't just do those posters. We try to do lots of different things.
But surely there's a danger. Say where you're putting tweets up.
Yeah.
And there's one, there's Dominic Raab one. I always felt, as from a personal point of view, I felt he'd been slightly wronged when this tweet came out. I hadn't quite understood the full extent of this, but we're particularly reliant on the Dover-Calais crossing. He didn't realise how much stuff went across between Dover and Calais. You can either say that is a completely stupid thing to say, but I could imagine him saying in the context of, oh, I mean, I didn't realise quite how much business did go across Dover-Calais. You know, it's, you know, taken out of context, it looks ludicrous, but in context, it might have just been sort of shooting the breeze. You've got to be careful with that stuff, haven't you? Otherwise, just sophistry.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And actually, you know, that wasn't taken out of context. He did say that, and, you know, you can watch the...
No, he said...
But I totally take your point, Adrian. I really, really take your point. I think it's a completely fair question. And we ask ourselves these questions as well. And we always ask ourselves as well, you know, are we punching up? Are we punching down? And we try to ensure that we're punching up. And at the end of the day, I think there is a problem with politicians of all stripes having said things and then not necessarily being held to account for them, you know, a few years later. And that's just something that we're trying to do with that campaign.
And so you talk about punching up or punching down. At times I felt like, well, what is it with people still sort of haranguing Liz Truss? You know, I got a bit squeamish when that, you know, you brought that banner down behind her while she was talking, and it was the lettuce. I thought, okay, I mean, like, she's not hiding away, so maybe she's fair game. But I thought, blimey, just leave it out a little bit now.
Again, a fair question. I can tell you, we decided to do that when Liz Truss was in America, and she was on stage with Steve Bannon, the far right activist and organizer. And she was aligning herself with the far right and pushing for Trump to be elected. And even when Tommy Robinson's name was mentioned, she did nothing to disavow Bannon of his support for Tommy Robinson. And there was that other thing happening with Liz Truss as well, where she simply had not accepted responsibility for the mini budget and what she did to people's mortgages. She was going around saying it was the Bank of England's fault, it was the Financial Times' fault, and she's still saying that now. And we felt, yeah, like at that point, she's fair game for an intervention, just to say, really, you need to take responsibility for this, but also supporting Trump. I mean, I personally am really worried that the two most recent former Conservative prime ministers, or two of the most recent ones, Johnson and Truss, are both supporting Trump. I think one of the big questions in British politics is whether the Tories are going to go Trumpy. And I think Truss needs to be held to account for supporting Trump.
I mean, I suppose now people will be looking out to see what you do now we've got Labour in power.
Yeah.
Now, is there going to be a book in 5-10 years' time saying, you know, called Led by Donkeys, The Starmer Years? I mean, how thick is that going to book? Is that book going to be full of clever stunts and the odd cheap shot and so on?
I mean, I don't know whether there'll be a book. We're really lucky to have one book, but definitely, you know, this government I think this government's probably going to disappoint us. Maybe in some respects, it's going to disappoint us profoundly. And led by Donkers will definitely be getting its teeth into this government. Absolutely. You know, they're fair game. I mean, I remember, for my sins, I'm old enough to remember being an activist during the last Labour government. And, you know, I and the other guys did loads of stuff against the Labour government then. And I'm sure we will this time. Absolutely.
Have you ever wondered what it'd be like to actually be in politics and actually trying to grind your way to getting elected and to, you know, get complex, some unpopular politics out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are heroes in politics. There are people that work really, really hard. It's not easy getting elected. I always admire people that go, you know, street to street, knocking on doors and talking to people and trying to persuade them. But I think, you know, I get where you're getting at with that question, but you could easily ask that to, you know, the political desk at BBC News as well, who, you know, do their work, trying to hold politicians to account, asking them hard questions, digging stuff out, that kind of thing.
Okay, thanks very much for talking to us, Ben. Real pleasure. That's Ben Stewart, one of the quartet, I think they are, who are led by Donkers. And this book, I suppose it's a kind of a, you call it a political coffee table book, I suppose, led by Donkers, Adventures in Art, Activism and Accountability, and published by Thames and Hudson. Some news just in, which I'm sure we'll hear in the news bulletin anyway, but rail workers have voted overwhelmingly to accept pay offers from train companies and Network Rail, just been announced by the RMT union. It's just gone 1:30.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Israel says it's carrying out extensive airstrikes on southern Lebanon. Lebanon's health ministry says the attacks today have killed 15 people. Earlier, Hezbollah fired a missile at Tel Aviv. It's the first time the Israeli city has been targeted. The missile was intercepted by Israeli military. The UK Foreign Office has urged British nationals to leave Lebanon while seats on commercial flights are still available. Additional troops are being sent to Cyprus as part of contingency plans to evacuate. Elsewhere, trade unions have narrowly won a vote at the Labour conference, calling for the government to reverse the winter fuel payment cut. The policy will affect 10 million pensioners in England and Wales. The result of the conference vote is non-binding. Ministers have defended the policy, saying the Conservatives left a £22 billion black hole in the public finances. And final figures show this year's London Marathon raised a record £73.5 million for charity. The event in April saw more than 53,000 people cross the finish line. That's the news. Shojo has the sport.
Manchester City say the full extent of Rodri's injury remains unclear as he continues to undergo tests. The clubs confirmed that the Spain international did suffer a knee ligament injury during their Premier League match against Arsenal on Sunday. It means Pep Guardiola will likely be without one of his most influential players for several months.
We have alternatives, we do it. When one player is irreplaceable, we have to do it as a team. And this is going to happen. We have last season 3 months without Erling, 5 months against Kevin, and we were there. We won the Premier League, despite of many things.
Manchester City were one of several teams to progress to the fourth round of the EFL Cup last night. Tonight, Arsenal host League One side Bolton. The Arsenal boss, Mikel Arteta, was asked how much he will prioritise this competition this season.
Well, in terms of trophies, the success, only if you win it, that's it. Success, how you measure success or how you associate that word to, I think probably we can have a much more deeper conversation. But we are here to win, and we are here to win the big competitions and the ones that even not considered that big. That's our duty.
Well, you'll hear regular updates of Arsenal Bolton on 5 Live Sport tonight. The commentary match will be featuring the holders, Liverpool versus West Ham at Anfield. That kicks off at 8. The West Ham manager, Julen Lopetegui, is under pressure after a 3-0 home defeat to West Ham in the league last weekend.
We need to have all our strengths put in thinking about Liverpool to be able to compete with them and to beat them. It's not going to be easy task, but we have to think that it's possible and we are going to go. We are going to have the plane thinking that it's possible.
Apologies, West Ham can't lose 3-0 at home to West Ham, losing 3-0 at home to Chelsea in the league last weekend. Also tonight, Manchester United start their Europa League campaign against Twente. United boss Erik ten Hag reckons they need to be much more ruthless in front of goal.
We create a lot of chances in the first games of the season. Last week we scored 7 against Barnsley, so we are capable of scoring many goals. But it's a part of the game. We have to be better there. We have to improve. We have to kill more in the box.
The former United and Real Madrid defender Rafael Varane, meanwhile, has retired from professional football at the age of 31. The 2018 French World Cup winner had been struggling with a knee injury since he joined Como in Italy over the summer. AFC Wimbledon have announced, or just announced, that their League Two home fixture against Accrington Stanley, scheduled for this Saturday, will have to be postponed. Wimbledon's pitch is unplayable after flooding earlier this week. They've not been able to secure a viable alternative ground. And the four-time major champion tennis champion Naomi Osaka has confirmed that she's teamed up with Serena Williams' former coach Patrick Mouratoglou. He was in her player's box for her first-round win at the China Open. That is the latest from BBC Sport.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Childs on Friday.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
It's 25 to 2. Matt Chorley coming up in half an hour. The continuing revelations about Mohamed Al-Fayed, the former owner of Harrods, have dominated headlines and TV news for the last few days. More than 20 women have now told the BBC that they were sexually assaulted by the billionaire. He died last year. 5 of those women say they were raped. Harrods says the organisation is utterly appalled by the revelations and they're conducting an internal review. The Al-Fayed estate is yet to comment. This morning on Breakfast TV, 5 women who say they were assaulted by Al-Fayed spoke to Sally Nugent and John Kay. Among them were Lindsay and Jen. I should warn you that this is obviously a story which involves descriptions of sexual assault. So if you'd rather not listen, then perhaps pop back in 5 minutes.
If we turn to you, Jen, you've decided to waive your right to anonymity for the first time. And you've asked us to explain what happened to you while you were working at Harrods. You say you worked for Mohamed Al-Fayed for almost 5 years. You've told us you were subjected to a number of serious sexual assaults and attempted rape. Why is it so important for you to speak this morning?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's part of the healing process. I have lived with this as a secret that I've been deeply ashamed of for 35 years. I hadn't told a soul. And when this action began a couple of years ago, it offered me the opportunity to perhaps deal with that trauma and begin to heal from the trauma. Initially, I didn't want to be involved because Mohamed was still alive. And as ridiculous as that may sound to people not involved, he still felt like a threat until the moment he died. His death helped me to be able to come forward without fear of any consequences. I've recently been able to tell my family, which has been a huge thing for me. It was something I hoped never to have to do, but I have now. And I would like to be able to appeal to anybody else who's been through something like this that hasn't yet come forward. And I'm hoping that in doing what we're doing, we will encourage more people to do the same.
And Lindsay, you would like us to explain your story. You worked as a personal assistant to Mohamed Al-Fayed for 5 months, from 1989 to 1990. You've told us He sexually harassed you, sexually assaulted you, groped you on a daily basis, and then trafficked you to Paris, where he attempted to rape you. You have no memory of your trip home from Paris, but did sustain significant injuries. You assume you were drugged. You were then falsely imprisoned in the Harrods management offices by a colleague under Mohammed Al-Fayed's instruction, but you managed to escape. And, Lindsay, we were just hearing from Jenna that the fear, actually, that has continued through the years, I wonder, having just heard a tiny bit of your story there, whether you maybe carry that fear with you now too.
I do. I mean, Harrods will never leave me. The thoughts, the memories I have from those tragic episodes, you know, are inside me. And, you know, I just think that Harrods need to have some accountability because someone paid for the medical. You know, I had an invasive medical procedure in order to get a secretarial job. And Harrods must have paid for that. You know, they enabled this whole team of people to... Who needs 25 PAs? They enabled all these people, enabled this situation and left us like lambs to the slaughter for one purpose. So the trauma is within me. There are lots of things that trigger me. Gypsy King's music... particularly.
Why that music?
Because he was always playing it. I don't know if he was in your eras, but he was always playing
Celine
that kind
Dion
of...
Celine Dion when I was there.
Celine Dion. the Roger and Galley soap. Yeah, so lots of things trigger me. And, you know, I just think that we won't ever get over it, but being together now is a fantastic support.
We should just explain to people who are watching as well. It's this morning, we've talked to you all beforehand about what imagery you're... okay with this morning, because we don't want to cause you any more extra distress about seeing and sensing things. Catherine, what kind of strength do you get from all being together? I could see you nodding and acknowledging stories that you were hearing from your newfound friends.
Well, yeah, I mean, watching the whole documentary last week, I was shouting at the screen because there were things that people were saying, and I was like, yes, that's exactly what happened. And that's what happened on Friday. You know, we met... the press conference and became instant friends, really, and we were swapping war stories and we all have the same pattern, even though if you lined us up, I think we go from the working there in the 80s to the mid-2000s, but nothing really changed from what he was doing. We were all in the same places with the same unlocked doors and our passports were taken away for the entire trip to France, and all of us had the same experiences. And being all together, I think it's quite good to think, oh, God, I thought for ages this was just me. Mm-hmm. I think it was Jen who said on Friday about walking out of there feeling 3 feet taller because, you feel like you're empowered by everybody else as well. So
you can watch the entire conversation with Jen, Lindsay and others on BBC iPlayer. There's also a documentary about the allegations against Al-Fayed on iPlayer, and you can read and watch much more about the story on the BBC News website. If you've been affected by sexual assault, there's a range of organisations and websites that can offer you advice and support. You can find them listed on the BBC's Action Line website at bbc.co.uk/actionline. You can also hear the organisations listed by calling for free on 0800 077 077. It's just gone 20 to 2. A rare 25p coin could fetch up to, well, lots more than that when it goes under the hammer in Wiltshire later. It's among a number of unusual coins being sold. The YouTuber Christopher Collects works with RWB Auctions in Royal Wootton Bassett. She's holding the sale. Go on then, Christopher. Tell us about this 25p coin. How many are there and why do they exist in the first place?
So hello, thank you for having me. It's a really exciting item that's come up for auction. So it's what's called a trial piece. So the Royal Mint, when they're making new coins, will create a few trial pieces because they want to check that they can mass produce that coin. But also, if you think about how many things out in the world use coins, so like vending machines, parking meters, they need to make some that can be sent out for these new coins so that they can calibrate the machines, make sure they roll through the machines. And this was created in 1981. They were trialing the idea of creating a 25 pence coin. Obviously, we know now that they didn't make a 25 pence coin. What it became was a 20p. So for your listeners, it looks like a 20p coin. It's got a very nice design on it, the Royal Mint's logo of the time. And on the other side, a little orb, like the coronation orb. But we're hoping it's got an estimate between £500 and £700. But all it will take is a couple of people who really want to pick this up and add it to their collection. And it could go for a very large sum, hopefully.
I'm trying to think what you could possibly buy for 25p anymore. I don't know, a gobstopper? Do they even exist? I mean, that dates me a bit, but you take my point. If you went into a corner shop and handed this over and you were buying something for 23p, would they say, well, there's not enough here? And you said, oh, yes, there is, my man. That's a 25p coin. You know,
So there are some 25p coins that were created before this, but they were big circular coins, about the size of what is now a £5 coin. They used to be 25p crowns. So I'm sure some of your listeners may even have some 1977 Jubilee crowns in their collection, which were given out to many school children of the year and available. Like, you could buy them at the post office for 25p at the time. They weren't intended for use in circulation. They were more collectors' items. And again, this item, you wouldn't be spending it, although I believe the person who found it did find it in their change and has put it into auction. So they got it for 20p, and it could potentially sell for £500 to £700, if not more, which is, again, you're not going to find those kind of treasures if you're just tapping with your card. No. So it's a call to arms to get out and spend some physical cash, and you might find something exciting in your change.
Well, it's odd, isn't it, that it got out into circulation. I mean, what should have happened to it? It should have stayed in the Royal Mint, but somebody sort of snuck it out by the sound of it.
Yeah, so these trial pieces, they're supposed to be returned to the Royal Mint because I guess it's still their property. I think if we think back to Edward VIII, there were some trial coins made in preparation for him becoming king and going on our coins. And I think it was the threepences that were sent out and about to the vending machine companies and whatnot. And then he abdicated the throne, and all of a sudden those companies lost those trial pieces and couldn't return them, which I think some people might have just taken them home thinking they're going to be really valuable. And again, the trial pieces are struck in such low quantities. That's what makes them really desirable, because they don't come up for sale all that often. And the one we've got that's coming up for sale later today is a bit rarer than a standard one. This depends on the metal content. So we see more of them coming up for sale that are made of cupro nickel, the same metal as your 50p's are in circulation. But this one is actually a nickel brass alloy. So it's a rarer version of a rare item, which is really exciting.
So is the numismatist community still thriving? Are their coin dealers still, you know, still feverishly searching websites and antique shops and so on?
Yeah, definitely. So I work for the Britannia Coin Company. We work in partnership with our sister company, RWB Auctions, who are running the auction. It's a great booming business. There's huge amounts of collectors out there, even though we are using physical cash less and less. The Royal Mint still produces lots of commemorative coins for collectors to buy and add to their collections. And there are still exciting coins like the Kew Gardens 50p out in circulation.
What's that one? Tell us about that one. So I need to keep my eye open. I live near there, so they won't go on lying around.
Yeah, so it's a 2009 dated coin. They were minted for circulation. It's got the great pagoda at the Botanical Gardens at Kew on the design, with some ivy going around it. If you find one of those, that is the rarest circulated commemorative 50p. They can sell for around £200 in a good selling market, and you could get one, as I did a few weeks ago, for just 50p if you're really, really lucky.
Well, I've come across coins in the past, or a friend of mine was given one or something, and it was from the reign of Henry II or something. It was a long time ago, and, you know, we were thinking, well, he's going to be a millionaire, must be worth a fortune. And actually, they're actually worth disappointingly little. Some very, very old coins. I mean, what? Just because they've, you know, there's still a load of them about, because I suppose coins don't decay, do they?
Yeah, so age does not equal value all the time. And we get some Roman coins in, which are about as old as coins get in the UK. And again, we can sell them for 50p a coin because there were so many. If you think back then, there were no debit cards, credit cards, checks, things like that. Cash was definitely king. It was the only way of paying for things. So sometimes just because you've got an older coin doesn't mean it's going to be hugely valuable, because people do keep them, or they've got metal detectorists that are discovering them all the time.
Oh, and what is the, you know, when a numismatist goes to sleep, what is their dream coin? What is the coin that they see on the inside of their eyelids, the one they dream about uncovering one day? What is that coin?
It differs from collector to collector. So I like my modern decimal coins. One of my colleagues, he much prefers his ancients and hammered coins. I think, my favourite coin is a £2 coin. It's the Frankenstein £2 coin. I think it was an absolutely lovely design. I got to meet the designer. He was a charming man as well. But I guess the one...
Wait, is that very valuable, that one?
Well, it wasn't put in circulation, so there's a bit of collector's value to it. It's worth more than £2 at least. But what I would dream about is the Edward VIII Trial Sovereign, which the Royal Mint have one in on display. I think the last one that sold of those was over £1 million. Again, my pockets are not that deep, but if they were, I'd definitely love to have one of those in my collection.
And what do collectors do with them? Do they frame them and put them on the wall, or squirrel them away somewhere?
So that it can be a sort of an investment. So in the future, you could, if you're collecting all these coins, and in the future you can potentially sell them. And so, like this this trial piece that's going on at auction later today, this is someone who's kept that for a while and decided now's the time to cash out, and is selling it and getting some more money for it. But it's about storing them safely. You don't want them to be affected by the packaging you're keeping it in, or the humidity and things like that.
I've just Googled the most valuable coin in the world. And okay. AI tells me it's the 1794 flowing hair silver dollar, sold for $12 million in 2022 at auction.
I think that does sound right. And there are quite a few American coins. The American coin market is humongous as well. Again, there are some stunning items you can get to collect out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nice talking to you. Thank you very much. That's the YouTuber Christopher Collects. And from 25p coins to something not quite as rare, the avocado bathroom. There are allegations in the press today that it's coming back. They're coming back into fashion. Professor Deborah Sog-Ryan is a design historian from BBC Two's A House Through Time. What was the era of the avocado bathroom, Deborah? Can you identify when it came in and out of fashion?
Well, the height of the avocado bathroom is, of course, the 1970s, when it was the absolute must-have. And in fact, my parents bought a house in Stevenage, Newtown, white bathroom suite. They took it out and replaced it with an avocado bathroom suite, and everything was avocado. The tiles, the loo roll holder, the toilet brush, everything.
Well, what brought it about? And was it called avocado at the time? Because I was young, but I don't remember being actual avocados being in circulation in the 70s.
Well, avocados were quite fashionable. They were as a starter, cut in half with a bit of vinaigrette in the middle. We certainly didn't eat them mashed up on toast in the 1970s, but they were pretty niche. But yes, an avocado bathroom suite was the height of sophistication. And I think it went alongside with a kind of 70s trend for nature. So if you look at what was happening in kitchens, this was the era of the stripped pine dresser, the good life, and that sort of back to nature thing. And so that sort of natural colour palette carried through into our bathrooms, along with things like macrame holder with a spider plant in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes, yes. I've seen a spider plant for donkey's years, actually, now you mention it. So what was, you know, who was it who sounded the death knell for avocado bathrooms? I mean, there are so many of them. It must have taken years to sort of get shot of them.
Yeah, well, there was an estimate recently that still having an avocado bathroom suite could knock $5,000 off the value of your house. But in the 1980s, you had slightly more muted coloured suites, so colours like sandalwood. And then in the 90s, really white bathroom suites took over. And when we started to embrace more minimalist styles, and I have to say the I word, IKEA. I think, you know, that kind of Scandi minimalism started to come in. So the avocado sweet has been out of fashion for a long time, but according to this new report by Wix, their research for their bathroom report, where they interviewed 2,000 people, it's back.
Right. Okay. I mean, if you want to go and see one on a field trip, Deborah, I can tell you where to go. You can go to Morecambe, where David still has one. Incredibly, David, I salute you. Tell us about your avocado bath and wash basin.
Yes, well, it's rather of a paler colour of avocado. What they define is actually...
Don't spoil it now. Avocado. It's avocado. It's good enough for us. Go on.
Yes. And, of course, I moved to this house in 1978, and it was already installed then, and I thought, well, if it ain't broke, why fix it, you know, and it works, and...
Yeah.
It's okay. It's where pragmatism and aesthetics really are inextricably entwined, aren't they, really?
Yeah. And have you had any stick for it? Have you had any visitors come in and say, what's that doing there, David?
No, they've never said anything about it, no.
I mean,
neither
just...
have they said anything about the wood chip, the magnolia wood chip either.
Yeah. Listen, I've had another text in, and I've been weighing up all morning whether to read this out, but I'm gonna do it. Right. It's from Susie in Blakedown, which is quite near where I'm from, and I think I might know Susie, but anyway. It said, not avocado, but a pink bathroom. The family tried for years to get my dad to change the bathroom from the old pink enamel bath. Eventually, we persuaded him, and the day the lovely new bathroom was finished, he reluctantly signed the cheque. And next morning, he popped his clogs in protest. I mean, look, Susie sent that in. And so, look, I'm sorry for your loss, Susie, but it said her dad never got to have a nice bath or shower. So, I mean, I'm encouraged to read it, David. It's just as an encouragement to you to keep the avocado bath there, because you never know what might happen if you get rid of it.
No, that's right. And I'm 66 next year, so hopefully I'm still in good health.
You've got many an avocado bathing experience to look forward to to get forward to yet, David. I mean, there might be some hipster around the corner who's looking for an avocado bath, so there might be a few quid in selling it. But it sounds like you've stuck with it since 1978. You're not going to get rid now, are you?
No. Emotions and nostalgia and various things from the 70s, you know, they're entwined in your emotions, really.
Built to last. Okay, David in Morecambe, thank you. Thanks very much indeed. I mean, Professor Sogryan, do you believe they are coming back? I know what PRs are like, trying to get their companies, you know, the company's name into the press. I have had reports that of a bathroom fitter saying that they are fitting more of these things now.
Yeah, interestingly, a lot of this trend for avocado is in tiles and accessories. However, I posted on my Facebook this morning about this, and a millennial friend posted me a photo of her avocado bathroom suite.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that's driving this is that loads of people are getting ideas for their homes from social media, from Pinterest, from Instagram, from TikTok. And I have to say that avocado bathroom suite looks fantastic on a mobile phone screen.
Interesting. And that is the important thing in life, what it looks like on a mobile phone screen. I mean, it might not be the worst thing, because everything, you know, you renovate a house, the windows have all got to be that kind of anthracite. 70% of cars are sort of monotone or somewhere on the white-black spectrum. You know, the colour has been drained out of our lives, hasn't it? You look at McDonald's, it's less red than it was. Kentucky Fried Chicken is less red than it was. Is something going to change?
Well, it's really interesting because I'm house hunting at the moment, so I'm spending a lot of time on property websites. And you're absolutely right, anthracite windows and grey. We've had a decade of grey. But we are seeing this kind of maximalist interior design trend, which started in the pandemic when loads of people were doing DIY. And I think, you know, because we were kind of locked out. And I think that's where a lot of those saturated kind of greens and blues come from, this sort of desire for nature and to bring the outside in when we couldn't go anywhere. So I think it is something we're starting to see is more colour in the home. And in a way, I think, you know, this trend is about making the bathroom a kind of individual space rather than just a purely sort of functional space.
Yeah. I mean, someone just said they fitted chocolate brown bathrooms back in the day against their old mum's advice. And, of course, she was right, as every trace of soap and talc showed up a lot. I mean, that is worth bearing in mind, isn't it?
Well, yes, yes. I have to say I am the woman who has black tiles in my family bathroom.
Oh, blimey, it must be a very clean living family. And what about somebody's just texted just 6-7 words, avocado bathrooms with crystal vanity ceramic tiles. Does that mean anything to you? It's just a series of words to me.
Yeah, yeah, that's a bit like the photo my friend texted me.
Oh, is it?
It's a spot-on interior trend at the moment. So they've obviously been looking at their socials.
Dave Studdard in Warrington has got a deep blue bathroom suite, and it's been there since the 80s, and he's pleased to say he's got it. Deep blue?
Well, high to fashion. I have to. I mean, I was up at the Kitchens, Bedrooms, Bathrooms big trade show at the NEC earlier in the year, and the trend there, and that's very much about future trends, is it's one-off pieces, so not necessarily the matching suite. So bathtubs and countertop basins in colours like deep blue, avocado green and pink.
Great. Well, you heard it here first. Professor Sog Ryan, thank you very much indeed. Deborah's from the BBC Two's A House Through Time. Thanks very much indeed for your company today. Matt Chorley is next. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday.
The Voice of the UK.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yeah, it's 2 o'clock, those bongs mean we're back in Westminster, leaving the party conferences behind. There's no one else in Westminster, though. It's the sort of day I could go and have a nap in Chris Mason's office. Today, 3 brand new MPs tell me how they're adjusting to life in the House of Commons. The political advisor whose life was changed by a chance encounter with a baby hare, perhaps the occasional sausage. But first, let's get the latest news with Alison Hughes.
Thanks, Matt. The Prime Minister is preparing to speak to the UN Security Council this evening after saying he fears the Middle East is on the brink of all-out war. Israel's military says it's carrying out a new wave of what it described as extensive strikes in Lebanon after the Iran-backed group Hezbollah fired a rocket towards Tel Aviv. Sir Keir Starmer has told British nationals in Lebanon to leave immediately on commercial flights. And Bougie, who lives in Beirut, says the UK advice isn't clear.
The government's decision to evacuate hasn't clarified whether family members would be allowed to travel with British nationals. So I don't know whether I could take my husband with his Lebanese passport only if a visa was available or not.
Members of the RMT union have voted overwhelmingly to accept pay offers from train companies and Network Rail. The RMT said the result meant its long-running dispute over pay and working conditions was over. Delegates at the Labour Party conference have backed a motion from the Unite Union calling for the government to reverse its cut to the winter fuel allowance. The vote is non-binding. The Work and Pension Secretary Liz Kendall defended the cut.
When we promised we could be trusted with taxpayers' money, we meant it. And when we were faced with a £22 billion black hole, which the Tories left this year, we had to act. But let me tell you, conference, this Labour government has done more to help the poorest pensioners in the last 2 months than the Tories did in 14 years.
Figures from the Co-op